Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
After Super Tuesday, the Republican establishment is going through three stages of grief, anger, bargaining, and depression, all at once. At the Republican debate, the candidates discussed their big ideas. And in less juvenile news, the women of the Supreme Court are drawing attention for their tough questioning in the Texas abortion case. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left, we have Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. On the right is A.J. Delgado. She's a conservative columnist and a lawyer. And our special guest is Christine Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey and former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Welcome to all of you. So Donald J. Trump won 7 of 11 states that voted on Super Tuesday. And according to my colleague Nate Cohn at The New York Times, he'll win an outright majority of delegates if he continues to do as well as he did on Super Tuesday. Establishment Republicans who spent months in denial have now snapped into action, trying to develop plans to stop Trump, many of which revolve around splitting the vote and then denying him the nomination at a contested convention, the first one since 1952. Oh, also, Republicans debated last night, and amidst unintelligible yelling, Donald Trump responded to previous insinuations from Marco Rubio about his hands and what their small size implies by assuring Americans, "There's no problem, I guarantee." So, Governor Whitman, you are not a fan of Donald Trump, but a whole lot of people in your party are fans of his, including your successor as governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. What do you make of Governor Christie's decision to endorse Donald Trump, and more broadly of the decision of so many Republican voters to support Donald Trump?
Well, a lot of people just don't want a continuation, another 4 years of what we've just had. And they're also lashing out because they want somebody who will tell them, "I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do." Whether or not they really believe they can do it at this point in time, I don't think they're even thinking that through. Because if they did and looked at Donald Trump's record of actual delivery, how great a businessman is he when he's taken four businesses through bankruptcy and has had a number of other failed endeavors in the business sector? You can start to parse this all down. But right now, people aren't thinking about that. They're just saying, "I want leadership. I want someone who's going to be out there saying this is what they're going to get done because I want to believe they can do it."
Were you surprised by Chris Christie's decision? I mean, he's a sophisticated guy. Shouldn't he realize that Trump's business record, for example, isn't what he makes it out to be?
Well, I had heard rumors that he might be going to do this, so I wasn't totally surprised. Disappointed, yes, mightily, particularly for someone who comes from a state as diverse as New Jersey. To be able to support someone whose whole premise seems to be dividing people, demeaning people, denigrating entire groups of people simply because of their ethnic background, that's very troubling to me. It can unleash emotions in this country that are hard to get back in the box. And I just am troubled by that kind of ability to suddenly turn around, because I thought he had had some very good critiques of Donald Trump when he was opposing him, and turn around that quickly and decide that no. Well, this has now become all about winning. I get it. You can't do what you want to do if you're not in office, but you also can't do it if the path to getting to that office is creating so many divisions in the country that you can never bring people back together again at the end of the day.
AJ, what do you make of all the brokered convention talk that we've heard in the last week? Do you think this is a viable path for Trump's opponents?
No, and I think your colleague Nate is right that I think Trump has reached some sort of critical mass of popularity that if it continues, which I think it will at this state, he'll just steamroll straight through into winning the convention nomination outright. I don't foresee a brokered one whatsoever.
So, Joan, I've been going sort of back and forth in my head about this brokered convention stuff. And the math works in the sense that if Trump started doing significantly worse, he wouldn't have to completely collapse. If he did significantly worse than he did on Super Tuesday, he could end up with less than half the delegates and we'd go into the convention. But the idea of how this would work politically, you'd go into Cleveland with Trump having 42% of the delegates or whatever, and you'd walk out of there with Mitt Romney or Marco Rubio or whoever is the nominee, and the party would just march forward toward the November election, strikes me as implausible.
No, it would be a bloody civil war. I mean, you know, I'm a Democrat. Let's state that up front. But it would be pretty hard to watch as an American. I mean, I don't root for Donald Trump. I really feel a kinship with people in the Republican Party who want to stop him. But stop him really means at this point two things. Either you deny him outright. You get someone, whether it's Ted Cruz, whether it's Marco Rubio or John Kasich, you get someone to beat him. Somehow, it seems impossible, but at some point in the next few months that somebody else accumulates the delegates, he falls apart and they beat him. Or else you give him the nomination and then you say, I'm not voting for him. I'll vote for Hillary Clinton. Because I think if you deny him the nomination, if he gets close, if he walks in the leader, you just repel his followers, who are a significant portion of the Republican base. All these people doing the math and saying, oh, he's only got, you know, he's only gotten 30 or 40% of the vote so far. There are 2/3 of the party is against him. That's kind of ridiculous, because as people drop out, Donald Trump actually picks up some followers. It's not like everybody goes over to Kasich or something. The math doesn't work, and I think the politics and even the morality doesn't work.
Governor Wibben, off of what Joan just said there, I know you've said that if Trump is the nominee, you would support Hillary over him. But for the most part, what I've been hearing from Republicans who abhor the idea of Donald Trump as the nominee, they can't bring themselves to say that. Either they won't entertain the idea of what they will do, or they say they'll vote for a third-party candidate. At the debate on Thursday, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz both said that they would, in fact, support Donald Trump if he were the nominee. Isn't that something Republicans need to reckon with? If Trump is as terrible as they describe him, they need to bring themselves to say that a Democrat is better?
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen whether they say it and how they vote. Those are two different things. Some people may not say things and go ahead and vote the way they wouldn't want to talk about in public. I've said, look, I don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. It's not my choice. I don't want another 4 years of what we've had. But if I thought this election was close and Donald Trump were our nominee, I'm certainly not going to vote for him. That I've made very clear. And there's still a write-in possibility. But if I thought the election were close, I could vote for Hillary Clinton.
I want to play something that Donald Trump said at the debate last night. This was a question that Brett Baer is setting up in response to something Donald Trump has been saying, that he'll, for example, have the U.S. kill the families of terrorists. And foreign policy military experts have been saying, well, that's illegal, and the military will refuse illegal orders. Here's Brett Baer asking him about that and what Donald Trump had to say.
The military will refuse because they've been trained to turn down and refuse illegal orders. So what would you do as commander-in-chief if the U.S. military refused to carry out those orders?
They won't refuse. They're not going to refuse me, believe me.
But they're illegal.
Let me just tell you. You look at the Middle East, they're chopping off heads. They're chopping off the heads of Christians and anybody else that happens to be in the way. They're drowning people in steel cages. And now we're talking about waterboarding. This really started with Ted. A question was asked of Ted last two debates ago about waterboarding. And Ted was, you know, having a hard time with that question, to be totally honest with you. They then came to me, what do you think of waterboarding? I said, it's fine. And if we want to go stronger, I'd go stronger too. Because frankly, that's the way I feel.
AJ, doesn't that scare you? I know you've been a supporter of Donald Trump, but do you really think it's a good idea to have a president who says the military will do what I tell them to do regardless of the law? Isn't that sort of the prelude to the breakdown of American constitutional government?
No, it doesn't scare me, because I don't think Donald Trump actually would end up asking the military to do anything illegal. I think he needs to kind of figure out where he's employing a bit of hyperbole and where he isn't. I don't think he actually would go through with that. But I will say, I find it ironic that some of the loudest pearl clutching and horrific reactions we're hearing to Trump's statements are coming from the neoconservative wing of the party, because these are the same people that pushed for and defended and still do defend the Iraq War, where where thousands and thousands of innocent children were killed. So to hear them express outrage over Trump's comments that we should go after terrorist families and to call that a war crime, it might very well be a war crime, but it just comes off as quite rich coming from the mouths of the fervent Iraq war supporters. So I think that's what's probably the most interesting here.
Joan, this is something I hear from Trump supporters and also hear from the left. And I've said versions of it myself, although I wouldn't say it about the military will do what I tell them to do thing, which is that basically Trump in a lot of ways isn't worse than other Republican candidates on these sorts of use of the military, foreign war stuff. In some cases, he's more restrained, seems less inclined to start foreign wars than Marco Rubio.
I agree on that. And I agree with AJ on, you know, how ridiculous it is for the neocons. Who were part of an administration that actually did commit war crimes to be clutching their pearls, as she put it. However, I don't think you can say I don't think he'll do that. I mean, you definitely can't say if it's a war crime, because it's a war crime. It is. So it's illegal. The military would be not only within its rights, but required to refuse such an order. And this is where I really have a hard time with a lot of the Trump supporters who seem to be picking and choosing what they like in what he says and believing the best, whatever they personally consider to be the best, about the really insane things that he says. I don't think you can have it that way.
Governor Whitman, how come this stuff is beating normal Republicans? I mean, you know, you're saying people are sick and tired of the last 4 years, and I think that is a very strong sentiment on the right, but isn't it literally the job of people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz to be offering an appealing alternative to Republicans as a substitute for the last 4 years? Why do Republicans prefer this sort of stuff over what the party has to offer?
Well, those Republicans that are voting for Trump are the ones who are the most outraged by what they've seen. They feel threatened. People are scared. When people are scared, they want to have someone tell them it's going to be all right, and I know how to make it all right. Whether they, at the end of the day, think that person really can or not, that's something else again. But right now, you're talking about people who are struggling to stay in their homes, who are worried about their civil rights, who are worried about the security of this country. They don't understand what's going on. They don't think we've had the kind of leadership that we have needed to have had. So they're just desperate. They're grabbing any kind of life raft that they think they can find. And that's why they're accepting some of this. What bothers me more about his saying these things is he puts us more in danger, as far as I'm concerned. As a president, it's one thing, it's bad enough to do war crimes. But when you say, I am going to order that kind of thing, you don't think that just drives another wedge and sends more people over to ISIS recruiters? You don't think when you say, we're going to do more torture and say it as a policy, that doesn't give our enemies license to do whatever they want, even though they're pretty much doing that now with our soldiers when they get, but it makes the hate deeper. It makes it much harder, I believe, over time to try to find an end to this kind of terrorism that we're facing around the world. It just drives more people away from us.
Well, let us know what you thought about Thursday's debate at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on that, plus women on the Supreme Court. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times and MSNBC. On the left is Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine. On the right is conservative columnist and lawyer A.J. Delgado. And Christine Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey and president of the Whitman Strategy Group, is our special guest. So one of the things Donald Trump talked about a lot in the debate last night when he wasn't talking about war crimes was trade. And sounding very protectionist notes on trade, the debate happened in Detroit and in a region of the country that has been really negatively impacted, I would contend at least, by foreign trade with China and other countries. And Joan, I'm wondering if what you heard worries you at all about a general election against Hillary Clinton, because Trump was really speaking to a lot of economic concerns of people in the middle of the country that I think establishment candidates on neither side of the aisle have really effectively addressed about what we will do about global globalization that has displaced American workers?
I think it's a concern. I mean, you know, when you tease out what's interesting about Donald Trump to me, when I'm not horrified, is that he has rejected a kind of free trade, austerity, tax cutting. I mean, he wants to cut taxes, but in general, he's not leading with that. He wants to cut taxes, but he's not talking about cutting programs. So he does, when he's not inveighing against Muslims and women and Megyn Kelly, he does talk specifically to the anxieties of the Republican base in a way that the establishment class and the donor class has not only neglected, but in fact pitched policies that are opposed to what those people want and what they need, whether it's on trade or Social Security. I think that is the thing that worries Democrats about facing Donald Trump, is that it's a populist moment. It's a moment where that, especially that white working class male, is really feeling under siege. And he may be able to speak to it more effectively than Hillary Clinton. I think if she's the nominee, which I assume, she's going to have to work on that.
AJ, what did you make of what he had to say about immigration and the labor market in the debate? Because he said a number of, frankly, contradictory things. He had said on his website that he opposed the H-1B visa program, which brings in highly skilled workers from other countries. But other places, he said he supported it. And the moderator asked him which one. And he was like, oh, well, you know, I support that. We need these people. And then he issued a statement after the debate that, no, the H-1B visa program isn't immigration and isn't high skilled, and I oppose it. He talked about how his hotels in Florida employ foreign workers because Americans won't do the jobs that he's hiring to do at those places, which is an argument that immigration skeptics usually scorn when immigration proponents bring it up. Is he consistent enough on this issue to really sell to voters that he's on their side?
Yeah, he actually is. He's not contradicting himself. He's not really changing his position. It's a complicated issue, so sometimes it might sound as though he is, but he isn't. He's actually never been against H-1B visas overall. He's just against the current way that we treat H-1B visas, and he's against increasing them as Rubio's Gang of Eight bill would do. Rubio's Gang of Eight bill wanted to double the number of H-1B visas. What Trump is against the abuse whereby we have, like what happened with Disney, where we have Americans that are able and are actually doing the jobs, but then are replaced by foreign workers, and the motive there is just because we can pay them less.
Governor Whitman, what kind of recalibration, if any, is needed on these issues? Because it seems like one of the areas where there's been the most bipartisan consensus, that free trade is a good thing, that we should have some sort of increased openness to immigration. There's been this groping toward a comprehensive immigration reform bill for more than a decade now. And I think the Trump phenomenon signals that those ideas can't be sold to voters. So are Trump and his voters right that the country actually needs to turn inward and be less open to trade and immigration? And if they're wrong, how do we convince people that trade and immigration are actually good for them?
Well, again, it's a balance. I think it would be wrong to turn away from that. But when you talk about fair trade, it should be fair trade on both sides. And that's not what happens. If you look at the way China regulates imports from the United States versus what we allow in this country and the taxing policies thereof, you can see that there's an imbalance. And I do believe that he is speaking to the public and the concerns of the working person when they see these things are just not in balance. However, having said that, if you start a trade war and all of a sudden the prices of everyday things go up because Lord knows just about everything we get is made in China, there are going to be some people that are going to change their opinion on that one really fast. But there's a lot that needs to be done to ensure that we do actually have free, fair, balanced trade. That's what needs to happen. As far as the visas are concerned, we need them. I don't know how quite frankly, his consistency does bother me because I know he was fined for hiring illegal immigrants. You can't deny that. It happened. So for someone who feels so strongly about ensuring that they are American jobs, his performance has not lived up to his rhetoric in that one. And of course, then there's just the whole idea of saying Mexicans, all the Mexicans coming over the border are illegal or rapists and criminals. That is, again, appealing in a way to people's most basest emotions, to their deepest fears. It's going to set off some ugly, ugly things in this country. And I just don't want to see that.
I do want to move to one. Yeah, go ahead, AJ.
Just to respond briefly to that, I just want to clarify, it was Trump's contractor who found and hired those illegal immigrant workers, the Polish ones, I assume the governor is referring to, not Trump himself. And also on the issue of the comment he made about those crossing the border, and he never said that all Mexicans or even everyone crossing the border, many of whom are not Mexican, were criminals and rapists and so forth. I just want to make that clear,
AJ,
because that distinction is often lost.
No, but
it's true.
But it was an inflammatory comment.
It's actually factual. Look, I'm Cuban, and when people say, hey, on the Mariel boat, if there are a bunch of criminals, that's fact that when you have a group of immigrants, among those, there will be some, especially so at the border where it's an unvetted border crossing. So, of course, you're going to tend to attract less law-abiding types.
American immigrants have a lower crime rate than native-born Americans in this country. Definitely criminals come over, but they're not mainly criminals. And that was a demonization of people that was both inaccurate and kind of ugly.
I think it's the core of his appeal, though. I think, you know, that people are wondering, you know, he's all over the map on immigration. He's for it. He's against it. He changes his position. I don't think he's going to pay a penalty with voters, because I think the thing he said that won his voters over on immigration was Mexicans are rapists. And a lot of those voters, if you get them talking in detail about immigration policy, they don't necessarily say deport everyone. They say the sort of inconsistent stuff that Donald Trump says. It's about keep the good ones, send the bad ones back. There are a lot of voters who voters don't really have opinions about policy. They have feelings about issues. And there are a lot of voters with just general negative feelings about Mexican immigration. And it's not an admirable thing. And Donald Trump identified it and has played off it. But that unadmirable opinion doesn't always translate into a pure hardline policy position on immigration, right, which I think is why what he's doing is not good for the country. But I actually think it is, in a perverse way, good politics. I do want to move on to one more issue, which is the Supreme Court, the argument they heard on Wednesday in Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. This is the case about restrictive laws that have forced the closure of many abortion clinics in Texas. Joan, why don't you talk about when this argument was happening? I feel like it got a lot more attention than normal. What was the big deal about this argument?
I think there are several big deals about it. I think, you know, this is a big issue, this Texas, horrible Texas abortion law. But I think we're also living in a time where the death of Justice Scalia has really changed the dynamics on the court. We heard Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, ask his first questions in 10 years. And then we saw, as the case was being made on the Texas abortion restrictions, the three women, female Supreme Court justices, really ask a lot of pointed questions and also get a lot of extra time from Chief Justice Roberts, who didn't quite seem to know how to handle this new assertiveness on the part of the women. And we also saw, and this is why I think it's whatever your ideas about abortion, this is why I think it's really important to have women in positions of power, and I'm so thrilled to be with two other women on this panel today, but that the female justices in particular were asking very practical questions. Texas has argued that these restrictions are necessary to protect the health of women, and Justice Ginsburg zeroed in and said, well, you're saying that, and that they don't place an undue burden, women don't have to travel too far to get an abortion since they closed a lot of clinics with these restrictions. And Justice Ginsburg pointed out that the case that they made, why El Paso women didn't have an undue burden, was they could go across the border to New Mexico to get an abortion, but New Mexico doesn't have these restrictions, so their health is not being protected. So there were just lots of moments where the female justices really punctured these arguments in a very practical way that showed how much they understood the issue.
AJ, what did you make of this case? Is there any substantive reason behind this Texas law that you heard advanced in the arguments, behind just a pretext to make it harder to get an abortion?
No, hang on to your horses here. I'm a pro-life conservative, but I actually agree with Joan because I'm also a lawyer, so I can't help but look at this from a legal perspective. And any way you slice it, Roe versus Wade is law. Roe versus Wade says you can't place an undue burden on those seeking to end a pregnancy, and these laws do. And I just don't buy the argument legally that this was just a matter of regulating health and safety. It's not. It does place an undue burden. So from a constitutional standpoint, I got to go with the honest legal interpretation, and I agree with the skepticism of the court against this law.
Governor Whitman, I thought this argument was interesting in part because of this 4-4 split, it's possible that we're going to get this inconclusive decision that could let the lower court decision stand without being precedent that binds the entire country. And that obviously goes back to these questions about will Republicans give a hearing to whoever President Obama nominates to succeed Justice Scalia. And I'm wondering how this is going to look if in a month or 2 months it becomes clear that Donald Trump is the Republican candidate. Is it really going to be tenable for Republicans in Congress to hold it up and effectively say, don't let Obama fill this seat so that Donald Trump can appoint who he sees fit to sit on the Supreme Court?
Well, I suspect, given what they've said thus far, that that's what they'll do. And from a political point of view, I think that played right into the hands of the frustration. It just magnified frustration of people to have the leader of the Senate say, I don't care who he sends up, no matter how good that person is, we're not even going to bother to hold a hearing. Politically, I would have said, fine, let him send him up, we'll have a hearing. But we might not do anything about it. And you don't even have to say that. Just let them send somebody up and see. Because if the president were, I would think, politically smart on this one, he would find someone that the Republicans, and I gather he's vetting several of those whom the Republicans have already approved, some of them more than once, and been the ones who stood up for those justices as they've moved on to the federal court. And then say, okay, now what are you going to do? Here's a moderate justice. Because what really worries me, and I made several appointments to the state Supreme Court in New Jersey, I didn't ever want to ask a justice, and I didn't, how would you decide a case on any issue? Because a particular issue like choice, what I asked them is, how do you decide your cases? And I want the answer to be on the facts presented in that case, not on my personal prejudices. If we undermine the public's perception of our rule of law, if we start seeing that justices are only appointed because of how we believe they're going to rule on a particular issue, we get into a very dangerous place and undermine one of the most important tenets of our country's foundation.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Joan Walsh, it's your soapbox.
I was very disappointed to see Governor Mitt Romney yesterday denounce Donald Trump and yet not make any reference to the fact that he courted Donald Trump's endorsement in 2012 at a time that Donald Trump was really associated with one and only one political issue, and that was insisting that our president was not born here and thus was illegitimate. Donald Trump was created by Mitt Romney, and it was really unseemly for him to stand up yesterday and not admit that.
The February 2012 event where Romney received Trump's endorsement is available on C-SPAN. It's a fun thing to go and look up. One thing is that Mitt Romney says that Donald Trump is a more successful businessman than Mitt Romney at that event. I don't think he'd say that today. AJ Delgado, what's your rant?
My pet peeve coming off of last night is the way Trump was treated at this debate. I was extremely uncomfortable with Megyn Kelly as a lawyer drilling him, what sounded more like a prosecutor drilling a witness on the issue of Trump University, which is a non-issue. It's about as big as an issue as eminent domain is. Come on, let's get serious. And if she was going to go after him on that, she should have gone after Marco Rubio on Corinthian colleges. I think it's been a disaster of a night and a debate for Rubio, who was pretty much outperformed by Kasich, and I would have liked to have seen the moderators go after him and Cruz far more than they went after Trump. It's becoming, it's getting to the level of being sickening already, and thank God we only have two more to go.
Governor Whitman, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm still trying to get my head around the Christian conservatives who were so outraged, and appropriately so, by the personal behavior of Bill Clinton, and yet somehow can see their way through to supporting someone who's been married three times and starts a debate last night by talking about the size of his personal parts. I don't want my grandsons watching these kinds of shouting matches when insult seems to be the only way to get attention. It's very, very frustrating and scary.
For my rant, a personal note, as we tape on Friday, today is my last day as a correspondent at the New York Times. I've had a wonderful 2 years writing for The Upshot, especially grateful to all of the fantastic work that my editors have put in with me over the last 2 years. I have an exciting new opportunity. On Monday, I will rejoin Business Insider as a senior editor. I will be an opinion writer again. I certainly have a lot of opinions about what's happening right now. It's the weirdest moment in American politics in my lifetime, and I am looking forward to being Unleashed, writing all about it. You can read me there, and of course, you'll still be able to listen to me right here every week. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Joan Walsh, AJ Delgado, and Christine Todd Whitman. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.